show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, Baseball Prospectus affiliate. Folks, the climate here, both metaphorically and literally, has been rising in Kansas City, and we've got a lot of fantastic Royal baseball things to talk about. But first, introductions. I am your host, Jeff Herr. With me, of course, the preeminent one himself, Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this fantastic, close to summer evening here in, I guess you're in Lawrence, but...
Same difference.
In the Kansas City metro area.
Pretty good. Yeah. I think, don't they say Memorial Day is the start of the unofficial start of summer?
I do believe so.
So I think the
summer solstice has not occurred yet. So I don't think officially we can say for any well actually.
Okay.
Out there. That's why I had to, I couldn't go full.
No, that's fair. That's fair. Don't commit to something if it's not completely factual. Respect that. That's fine. It's plenty warm enough though.
Yes,
and I mean, humid.
The pools are open. The lake houses are open. Most people have, and it's as far as I'm concerned, it's summer. But factually, I didn't want to misrepresent anything here. So
that's usually that's a good idea.
We're about factual representation on this show. That's what we're here for.
Right. So get ready for 50 minutes or so of opinion.
Exactly.
But based on facts.
Based on facts. Well, it's a fact that it is, in fact, our opinions. So there's
That's true.
So great way to start the show here. But as we want to talk about the Royals, folks, last time we talked, I believe they were 24-22, and they were kind of starting to pick up steam. And since then, the Royals have gone on a six-game winning streak. We talked about last weekend. Damn if we didn't absolutely call what was going to happen. We didn't necessarily predict it, but we were talking about how it wasn't unreasonable to think the Royals could win 3 or 4 from the White Sox. One of the games got rained out, first game of the series on Thursday night, and so they only played 3 games, and the Royals went ahead and just swept the whole damn thing. And then they go or they stay at home, and Tampa Bay comes in town, and they sweep them. Now, we'll focus on the White Sox series for now, of course, but the overall picture for the Royals, three weeks ago, they were 7.5 games back, I believe, at the worst of the Chicago White Sox. And now they have a 2.5 game lead on the White Sox. So that's a 10-game swing in the span of less than a month. I mean, it's very impressive. And, the 3 wins against the White Sox, I mean, it was Royals playoff baseball at its absolute finest. The first game, they go into the seventh inning, trailing 5-1, and they come back and they win that game. In the second game of the series, they go into the ninth inning, trailing 7-1.
Still doesn't even make sense.
And rookie Brett Eibner gets an incredible walk-off hit to score 8 runs in the bottom of the ninth and win it in a walk-off. And then yet again in the seventh inning on the third game, the Royals are trailing 4-2. And they come back and they win it again to sweep the whole series. The second game, the ninth inning comeback, was, I believe, the largest ninth inning comeback in Royals history.
Mm-hmm.
And then I believe that was the first time in Royals history that they've won 3 consecutive games when trailing in the seventh inning or later.
Probably. I hadn't seen that, but that makes sense.
And it was the first time that they had won 6 consecutive games at home, on a homestand, since 1988 or something.
It was the last time they swept a homestand of six or more games. I think last year they started 7-0, but it was a 3 homestand start, I think is what it was.
Yeah, okay. So that's something like that. Swept a homestand. I knew there was something, but
yeah, but still.
Point being, a lot of history, a lot of Royals history was eclipsed in these past 6 games, not to mention after that White Sox series. I think that's kind of the big upswing here of the season in terms of fandom. And then you had in 2 consecutive nights on Tuesday night and Wednesday night of this. We're recording Thursday, June 2nd for a little frame of reference there. But the Tuesday night game against the Rays and the Wednesday night game against the Rays consecutively broke all-time ratings records for the Royals. Just a random Tuesday night game against the Rays and just a random Wednesday night game against the Rays in May. Of all times. So pretty insane what the Royals have been doing, and they're 30-22 now. They are leading the division by 2 games over the Indians and 2.5 over the White Sox. Or do I have it backwards?
You got that
2
backwards.
2 over the White Sox, yep. 2.5 over the Indians, and they play the Indians tonight as they start is it 3 or 4 game series?
It is a 4 game series. Yep.
So they're going to play a 4 game series against the Indians. And
yeah, I mean,
they got some room to make some. If they win 3 out of 4 against them, then that bumps that lead to 4 games at least on the Indians. So depending on what the White Sox do, I mean, the Royals just could kind of lengthen that lead here. So I mean, it's been kind of a whirlwind this last couple weeks, as you know, Dayton Moore has 2 years ago, I guess, he made his 15 of 20 comment, 16 of 20 comment about how I think we're really close, and they did it in the second half of 2014. And it seems like every year we kind of bring it up somewhat ironically, kind of jokingly, and they do it again. And they've won 15 of their last 20, unbelievably so.
It's crazy.
I mean, put this into you're better with words than I, Mike. So put this into some perspective here. For the Royals fans, well, I mean, this is—it's phenomenal.
Yeah. I mean, it's just that
dynamite drop in.
That series against the White Sox is pretty much like that's one of those things. Like the Royals come into this season, and you know nobody expects them to be good, just like they had in the last 2 years, and they come into this game against this series against the White Sox, and I mean. Realistically, they should have lost, you know, any of those games. They really should have, but they managed to pull out wins. And that's got to be a hugely energizing factor for a team, especially like the Royals, like a team that really builds off of those kinds of things. And when you look at the division, I mean, the Tigers aren't playing very well. The Indians are playing okay, but they're not scary. Or anything, and the White Sox have pretty much tumbled ever since they got out to that really hot start in the first half of April. You know, they're basically running on 2 starting pitchers and Melky Cabrera, and that's about it. That's what they have going for them right now. So you get to that series against the White Sox, and not only sweeping it, but sweeping it in that fashion is like it's like the big brother letting you win for a little bit. You know, and then going on like a, you know, you're playing pickup basketball or something, and oh, it's 9-1, and oh, now all of a sudden he scores 10 points and you lose, and you know, he was just toying with you the whole time. You know, that's kind of what it's like when you look at how they treated the White Sox. Not to say that they were, you know, messing around with them, but you know, the White Sox gave them room to do that, to come back, and they did it, and it was crazy and exciting, and it just really seems to sum up what this team has been about the last couple of years, where you know, you look at the wild card game, you look at the Houston game, you look at games 4 and 5 against the Mets in the World Series. I mean, the David Price game in the ALCS, this is just what they do. I mean, we talked to Jonah Carey last week, and he talked about this cluster luck, and you know, they just went on a tear. Like, everybody in the lineup was hitting at the same time, and you can go and win 6 games. And, you know, if everybody on your team is going to hit, you got a good chance to win a lot of baseball games. And that's what they did. They, you know, it just seems like anytime you needed a hit, a guy was getting a hit. And, you know, Eric Hosmer and Lorenzo Cain, you know, pretty much drove in everybody they had opportunity to drive in. And they got just good enough pitching. They got the trademark bullpen effectiveness. And, yeah, you sweep a homestand. You win six in a row in a spot where you could really use a surge like that to, one, jump into first, and, two, put yourself in a position where you go to Cleveland, and if you can win three out of four, like you said, that starts to put a little bit of distance. You know, not that it's insurmountable, but it's a little bit of distance, and we're already a third of the way through the season. A little bit of distance is a good thing, and if the Royals can keep chipping in, keep adding to it, I mean, that bodes well. You know, they're playing as good as they've played in the last couple of years in this past week, and to go to Cleveland with the opportunity to extend a lead, it's just a great opportunity for them. I hope they take advantage of it.
Yeah, you know, they've won six consecutive series, so I mean, just keep winning series, and you're gonna, especially with a series like playing coming up against Cleveland, or that they've started now against Cleveland, winning those series, not only winning them, but against division opponents, that's what's gonna increase that lead. And it's kind of funny the way you talked about that White Sox series. I hearken back to my high school years. I had a friend of mine. We used to play basketball a lot in the park, in the driveway. And a friend of mine, Stefan was his name. He used to always beat me. Always. I mean, I'm not very athletic, but regardless. So like every once in a while, I'd have a game. You know, we played a 10, whatever. I'd have a game where I'd like be up, you know, 9-7 or something. And I'd be like, oh, man, this is it. And then it would just, like, just one keep flip it on, and he'd always beat me. And it was always so frustrating. That's what it feels like. That has to be what it feels like, you know, to play, especially for the White Sox just now. But, I mean, the Royals have been kind of doing it for the last couple of weeks. And, you know, if they keep on doing it, and I think there was a little bit when the Royals were in that downside, there was a little bit of that kind of, okay, this isn't the same team as last year. They're not infallible anymore. They're not just going to come out of nowhere on us. You know, I think those kind of mentalities can seep into the rest of the league there. And then, but if the Royals keep doing what they're doing, they keep making the headlines, keep being in first place, winning games, then it's going to be like, uh-oh, you know, the scary Royals are back. Yep. And teams are going to start. You know, I do think you like to think that players don't, that kind of stuff doesn't really factor in. But, I mean, it does. I honestly believe that it does. And There's a tightness playing against the Royals. You can see it on the field. Players that have no business making errors because they're too good and it's just not what they normally do, make errors against the Royals. And, you know, we've talked about it before, kind of like in tennis. You have the forced versus unforced errors, you know, and Royals force a lot of errors. You know, there's the – I mean, you can say errors happen, and they do, but, you know, it just – You see people from other fan bases say, oh, you know, the Royals just, you know, fluke and bloop and error their way to winning all these games and everything. It's like, well, I mean, I guess, okay, you can make that argument. But at the same time, if there's enough of an evidence there, then, you know, there could the Royals are causing these things. It could, you know, you've there's got to be some credence to that. And, you know, I mean, Carlos Correa is a great shortstop. Mm-hmm. And he biffed that play in game four last year. And it's like, you know, that's a play he makes 90% of the time, 95% of the time. It wasn't an easy play, but it's one that a player of his caliber makes. And it's like that, mm-hmm. You know, those types of things, that I guarantee you some of the Royals had something to do with that. And those, some of those, you know, you could see it when Dale Murphy's not a very good second baseman, but he rushed a lot of those plays because in the back of his head, he knew what was going on with the Royals and stuff. So, you know, I don't want to get too deep into that, but I do think it matters. And I think the more the Royals keep doing Royal things, then the more it's going to get into people's heads. And just like it did last year. And, you know, the Royals are going to be hard to beat on the field, but they're also going to be hard to beat mentally. And that's one of the things in this last couple, 2-3 year run that the Royals have really had. Mentally, I think they're stronger than a lot of teams. And, you know, however much weight you want to place on that, I think it's a factor.
Yeah, I've gotten to the point where I can't dismiss that because I've seen it so often from the Royals. And I think there is something that the other teams have to face when the Royals start making a comeback, because it's like, well, here they go again. and you start to get, and you can feel that pressure tightening on the other side a little bit. I mean, I've been in that spot where I was, you know, coaching Little League, and we had like an 8-run lead on a team, and they got a couple hits, and you could kind of sense that, okay, guys are playing a little tight, and then someone boots a ball, you know, that they would normally make a play on, and you can just kind of see that, okay, now you're starting to get that little hint of doubt. And at the big league level, you can't have that. And, you know, I think if you get a team to where they start to sense that it's getting away from them, I think that's where the Royals are particularly good at drawing out. Like, maybe that's where they get their long at bat. Maybe that's where they get that one hit that just gets through. Maybe that's where they're pushing the envelope and trying to get the extra base. And those kind of things can frustrate a team. And I think that probably by that third game in the White Sox series, they were ready to get the heck out of town. Because, I mean, that's just got to be demoralizing. I can't imagine you leave and that's a happy flight in any way other than the relief of getting out of Kansas City. So I don't think you can dismiss it. I mean, you can debate maybe how much of a factor it is. But if it's, you know, a little extra 1% one way and 1% down the other way, that can sometimes be enough. I mean, if you're making a comeback like that, you're usually winning by one or maybe two runs, and can be the difference between an out or a hit. So, you know, you can't just shove it aside. And I think that's what the Royals have kind of, some of it lucky, but it's kind of what they've been able to make their trademark over the last couple of years. And it's really fun to watch. So,
yeah, I mean, and it's not to say that the Royals don't get their fair share of luck, but, you know, yeah. I mean, luck's a huge part of baseball, more so than any other sport. And a lot of it is the Royals making their own luck, too. And, you know, part of that is coming from players who, you know, the Royals had a lot of players that were starting slow to begin the season. And we said, you know, this isn't going to continue and players are going to snap out of it. And don't look now, but actually go ahead and do look now. But Lorenzo Cain is hitting .305. I mean, everyone was like, uh-oh, you know, those last two years were maybe just a blip after Lorenzo Cain. He started he was about, you know, right around 200 or whatever, just with Alex Gordon. And then it was like, oh, you know, he's going to come back to earth. People know how to play him now, and it's all over for him and everything. And everyone was really really quick to jump. Oh, he's swinging too hard. He wants to hit home runs and all this business.
Or he's not even trying to get down the line. He's
he's 70% effort. Step and a half slower than he was a year ago and all this stuff. And now all of a sudden he's hitting for power, doubles, home runs. Was he at seven home runs on the season?
He's at eight.
Eight now, okay. And
which is half of his career high from last year.
Yep, and he's hitting .305. And, I mean, playing great center field again. Like, he's looking every bit the MVP candidate he was last year. And that's a really good thing to see, because I was pretty bullish on Lorenzo Cain again this year, and I didn't think that the 200-level hitting was going to continue, but I did not think that – I didn't realize he'd be able to raise it, not only raise his batting average up to that 300 level, but do it so quickly. I mean, it's been quite impressive to see not even just the last homestand, but the last couple of weeks, what Lorenzo Cain's been able to do.
Yeah. In his last 30 games, he's hitting .358 with six home runs. So, I mean, it's not like it was just this homestand, but in his last 11 games, he's hit .444 and driven in 13 runs. And, you know, he's just hitting for power. He's hitting doubles. You know, for the longest time, he didn't even have a double. Mm-mm. He had those two homers in the first 2 weeks or so. And then after that Houston series, he didn't have an extra base hit for a while. And now he's doing it with regularity and just hitting well, you know. And the thing was that for so long, Eric Hosmer was basically the only guy doing anything. And then Cain stepped up. And so now, you know, now you've got those guys at 3 and 4. I think they're 2 and 3 in the lineup tonight. Yeah. You know, that's pretty big. That's nice, because then you've got, you know, whoever can get on, you've got a good shot at getting that guy home. And that was a big part of this homestand, too, because anytime they had a guy to drive in, they were doing it. In those last six games, so that last homestand, Eric Hosmer was 14 of 26, drove in 12 runs in a six-game homestand. With two homers, three doubles. So just doing exactly what you would think a guy hitting third or fourth in a championship caliber team should be doing. Mm-hmm. He's doing exactly that. And he didn't walk. He's really not walking lately, but they keep pitching to him. They keep giving him pitches that he can hit. So if you don't even get to a three ball count because you hit the ball in the gap or into the fountains, well, I'm going to be okay if he doesn't walk. That's fine. It's, you know, but it is kind of interesting to just see that, okay, he's not walking. And so, you know, I think it was a week or so ago, we were talking about, oh, he's slumping. You know, he's in that slump. How long is this going to last? Well,
we were talking about how it was a disturbing trend, actually, for the last couple of years.
Right, right. So he was hitting .336 with a .398 on-base percentage and a .568 slugging at the last point before that slump started. Going into tonight, he was hitting .328 with .373 on-base percentage and .547 slug. So roughly the same. It's a little lower because, you know, he has not walked, but he's basically at the same point that he was when we were worried about a slump. So, I mean, I guess if it's going to be a week-long slump at a time, will work, especially if you're going to come back. Yeah, if you're going to hit .500 to get out of it, that's okay. I'm kind of okay with Eric Hosmer doing that. Yeah, it's like it doesn't even sound right. Like .500, oh, he hit .500. That's an exaggeration, but he really did it. He did better than that. He hit like .538. I mean, that's crazy. Like, people don't really do that, but he did it over the last six games.
Yeah, and I mean, if we're at the point now where you can essentially almost exactly a third of the season, so you can just kind of real easy point to just extrapolate what his stats will be. I mean, if he has his line that he has now, which, like you mentioned, you know, .328, .373, .547, .921 OPS, and then if we can effectively triple his home run total from 10 to 30 and RBI total from 35 to 105, then and, you know, his doubles as well from 12 to 36, then that's the kind of and his that puts his OPS plus at 146. Compare that to last year's MVP winner, Josh Donaldson. His line was 297, 371, 568 last year for a 939 OPS, and he had a 153 OPS plus. So, you know, it's he had the 41 home runs, so he's kind of a lead and 123 RBIs. So the home runs RBIs are going to be a tick higher than Hosmer's projection. But, you know, Hosmer's also, you know, Donaldson's a pretty good third baseman, but Hosmer's also gold glove first baseman. So that factors in as well. You know, so it's a thing where, you know, similar to Kane last year, and we talked about Kane being a legit MVP candidate, and depending on how you try and define that type of an award, right, whether it's truly most valuable player or whether it's best player on the best team type of thing, you know, Lorenzo Cain was very valuable to the team last year, more than he was just being, you know, one of the best players in the league and happened to be on the best team in the league. So depending on how you want to define it, you know, either way, I think for this year, Eric Hosmer is a legitimate candidate for that. And it's been really, you know, we were, like you said last week, we were a little down on him, wondering about his slump, if it was going to be another month-long thing or if he was going to be able to. We even talked about how, you know, all the stars, they, you know, they go in slumps. Bryce Harper's had slumps. Mike Trout, Miguel Cabrera, you know, those guys, they go in slumps. But they, like you said, they get out. Not only does it not last very long, when they get out of it, they hit the 500 to get out of it. So if he becomes that guy and it starts to take that step towards that being that elite player, this is one of the ways that you do it. You might have a weak slump and then you hit 500 for a couple weeks and then
you
level out, and then you might have another slump and you get back out of it again. So if that's what he does, then I'm totally okay with it. And that puts him in a really special category. And he's for that first kind of month and a half of the season, he really carried this team. And then when he slipped, the team kind of started to slip. And then now that he's come back out of it and Lorenzo Cain has snapped out of his, and those two just kind of just together like that have really, really picked up this. It's been fun to watch those guys. I mean, really, it did kind of look a little bit different when they were kind of in that slump, the team, I mean, and just, you know, it didn't quite look like the same Royals baseball that we were used to. And these last 2 weeks, it's looked like they're back. It looks like Royals baseball last 3 weeks, really. It looks like that the the intensity is there, the fire is there, the same kind of frenzy hitting, as you like to say, is there, the just all of it. It's back, and it's a beautiful thing, as Rex Hudler would say.
And the thing, it's strange to have it happen also after the loss of Alex Gordon and Mike Moustakas, who collided 2 weeks ago almost in Chicago. Ended up, you know, Gordon's probably going to be out till I think July as their guess now with the broken bone in his wrist. Mm-hmm. But Moustakas had surgery on it for a torn ACL today. So he's out for the year. And so, you know, you're doing this without two guys who are all-stars and anchors on your team.
And sorry, I don't want to interrupt, but have you done much research? I know what a ACL injury, what the recovery, what that takes for like football, but I haven't really, because it's not a very common baseball injury. Have you done any research into what the typical, like, will he be ready at the beginning of next season, or will it be like a full year?
They expect him to be ready for spring training with no issues. So,
I assume it would probably be a little bit easier in baseball, but.
Yeah, it's not. There's not as much like stop, pivot, and, and quick, you know, quick changes and things like that. But I think it's, I don't know. It always depends. But they said today the reports were that all the damage was just in the ligament. There was nothing else in there. There was no like meniscus issue. There was no other ligament damage. It was just the one. So they just have that one procedure to take care of, and there was nothing else to clean up. So that should help as well. You know, I never really heard if it was fully torn or partially torn. I assume probably fully, but, you know, but they expect him to be back. Now, I've read a little bit that, you know, most players, when they do come back from those kind of surgeries, that you can't expect them to be as productive as they had been, which I guess makes sense just because it's a knee thing, but I mean, we'll see how it is. I mean, Moose has, you know, never really had this kind of a surgery before, so I don't know how he's going to react, but we do know that he's not going to be back this season, so they do have a big hole to fill there, and they've got a big hole to fill in left field with Gordon out, even though he was struggling. So, you know, and then on Saturday they had the another collision on a foul ball where Sal Perez got hit in the calf and ended up getting a deep contusion, and so he's been out for the last almost the whole week here, and Drew Butera has been in his place, and Drew Butera is on fire. Like, you know, he came in with he was 3-for-3 last night and walked. He homered tonight before we started recording, and, you know, just, he's got a couple doubles. He had that big double in that Saturday comeback to tie the game, and he ended up scoring the winning run. So, you know, Salvi goes down, someone steps up. Gordon goes down, Paulo Orlando goes on a tear. Moose goes down, they call up Chesler Cuthbert, they end up bringing up Whit Merrifield and Brett Eibner, who we haven't really talked about yet, and those guys go on a tear too. So, I mean, that's the other part of it, is that the Royals, yeah, they're getting what they expect from guys like Kane and Hosmer, but they've also had these other guys that we haven't seen step up yet who are now stepping up. And I think that's kind of the best part of it, because that gives you some kind of hope that, okay, beyond that kind of crazy magical White Sox series, you might have some staying power with these guys, even if they're untested, even if we haven't really seen them against big league pitching. They're performing right now in spots where they really need to step up. And, you know, that seems like its own kind of, I guess, good fortune just on its own. So those guys have been instrumental in this kind of stretch as well. So
yeah, I think one of the more positive outcomes from all this is that, you know, it's kind of in line with what you're talking about. The Royals have done so well this, you know, to dig themselves out of the hole that they dug for themselves. But the best part of it is nobody's really playing all that above their heads right now. And so I guess there's kind of two sides of this coin. You know, we talked about Eric Hosmer and the idea being that this is his new baseline. This is the player we always thought he was going to be, and that now that he's becoming that player. So it's not like he's, you know, we're hoping this, you know, this can be the new baseline for him. So if we can accept that, then he's not playing, you know, way above his head. Lorenzo Cain is doing pretty much exactly what he's done the last 2 years with a little bit more power. So there's no reason to think that that's going to, you know, revert back to 200 batting average. But Alex Gordon, before he got injured, was struggling big time. And Moose was hitting lots of home runs, but in terms of batting average and stuff, he wasn't off to as hot a start as he was last year. You know, Chester Cuthbert, he started off pretty decent, and then he's kind of slowed down quite a bit. You know, Paolo Orlando has been incredible, and he's been playing way above himself. And then Merrifield has. But outside of those two guys, the rest of the team, you know, I already mentioned Gordon, but and Moose, but Kendrys Morales has been playing way below his baseline, or what his baseline should be, you know. And then Omar Infante has still been giving you nothing when he plays.
Right.
And, you know, Jerrod Dyson's been solid but unspectacular. So, you know, with the exception of those two guys, and, you know, Brett Eibner, before he got injured, he was doing, you know, he was playing pretty well. And so that's kind of the linchpin there is, and Paolo Orlando, this might just be kind of a hot streak. It's not necessarily something where you say, okay, the league might need to adjust to him. Paolo Orlando's been around long enough now after all of last season and everything that you know, teams know what he's about. So he's just on a really hot streak right now, and he'll probably cool off at some point. But, you know, Whit Merrifield is the big one. He's hitting like 350 or something, whatever, you know, just doing incredibly well.
He's basically getting two hits a night.
Yeah,
pretty much.
And part of it is he's being challenged right now by major league pitchers with their fastballs, because a lot of times when new hitters come up and you don't necessarily have a book on them yet, you say, okay, you know, you haven't seen a ton of major league pitching. We're going to just see what you can do. And he's showing that, at least in those terms, when pitchers are just challenging with the fastball, he can hang, and he can hang really well. And he's playing good defense, and he's been a bit of a point of consternation on the internet here, Mike, in the Royals Twitterverse, if you will.
A little bit.
Because you've got the next big thing people, the people that were ready to anoint Jimmy Gobble, maybe, that
are
ready to say Whit Merrifield is going to be a star, or he was just somehow missed by all these people, and that Whit Merrifield is going to be this great player all of a sudden. And then you've got the flip side of that, which is, oh, Whit Merrifield is just because they're, you know, they're not used to him yet. The league's going to adjust. He's going to flame out and start being awful, and he's going to end up back in the minors, and he'll just be like a fun little story that people might remember a few years from now, but that's it. So those are the kind of extremes. Like many things in baseball, it'll probably lie somewhere in between. But what you can't dispute about Whit Merrifield right now is how spectacular he has been over the last week or so. And I mean, the Royals, just regardless of how much value they get for the rest of the season in this little winning streak here, which may be the most pivotal point of the season when we look back at it, he's been really good for him.
Yeah, I mean, he's, you know, I think it's right on. And Hunter Samuels had a really good piece on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City about, you know, how pitchers are still just going right at him, because the scouting report is he doesn't have a lot of power. He had a good program this offseason where he did add some weight, some muscle to try to get a little bit more power. But his game is really make contact, be fast, and just try to get doubles and hit it into the gap and down the line and get the ball through, you know, whatever hold you can find. And that's what he's been doing. He's hitting the ball really hard. He's hitting it well. And it's going to be up to how he does adjust to the league when they start to change their approach to him. And that's always kind of the test for all of these guys. You know, we saw it with Hosmer in his second season. We've seen it with Chesler Cuthbert this year. And you see how the league adjusts to a guy, and then it's up to the batter to adjust in kind. And so far, he hasn't had to adjust. They just keep putting it over, and he hits it. And it's as easy as you can get. You know, ball over plate, ball for single. You know, that's it. It's that simple. So we'll see how he adjusts. You know, I think he can be effective. He's been a pretty solid minor league player the last two seasons. I don't think anybody really expects him to be the second coming of Ben Zobrist, but he's got that same kind of versatility, which adds value. He can play all those positions well, and he's got the speed to be the Royals type of guy that we've come to expect in the lineup every day. And if anything else, he's probably going to play more second base than any other position, which means that you don't have Omar Infante in the lineup. And he can certainly hit better than Omar Infante, I have to imagine. It's not a high bar to clear.
No, it's not.
So, you know, if people want to get excited, I mean, it's exciting to see a kid come up and do that. We don't usually, we've talked about it dozens of times probably in the whole run of this show, is that the Royals don't often get those guys out of nowhere who come in and contribute. And right now he's doing that. And they kind of got the same thing from Ebner, and, you know, it was only four games. But on Saturday, it was a pretty big game for him. You know, he hit a double to keep the rally going in that ninth inning, and then a 10-pitch at bat to get the walk-off hit. You know, I think people get excited about him, too, because he's hitting right out of the gate. And it's the same thing. If they start testing him out of the zone and he chases, this is when he comes back from his injury. You know, he's going to have to adjust to that, too, because it's always been a thing of contact for him in the minor leagues. But you're also, at the same time, looking at guys like Merrifield, who was never really a top 30 prospect guy for the Royals. He was never really in any of those rankings. You may be a fringe guy. Ebner was always around, you know, in top 10, you know, maybe in that 10 to 20 range for the most part, but, you know, dropped out of Baseball America's prospects rankings 2 years ago and got back on last year. But these are both guys who are 27. Their best years are probably right now. So I can't expect these guys to be like superstars, but if they can be, if Merrifield can be a better everyday second baseman than Infante, and if Ebner can come back and be a good fourth outfielder, that's probably all the Royals need, and I think that's enough. So if they can adjust to the league, you know, they don't have to be this 360 hitter or 462 hitter. They can hit 280 and maybe get on base and do everything on defense that they're asked of. And that's enough, because you've got Kane and you've got Hosmer and Perez when he gets back from his injury, which should be this weekend. You know, those guys can carry the rest of the team. These guys just need to fill their role and do, you know, what they're doing now. And if the league adjusts and they struggle, you know, so be it. I don't think anybody expects them to be Rookie of the Year or win a batting title or anything. But, you know, it's still fair to get excited because it's new players. They jump up, they fill roles, and they're performing at a high level that we're not used to seeing guys just come in and do. And so excitement's fine. There's nothing wrong with excitement. You do have to temper it because, you know, if these guys were superstar caliber, they'd have been here sooner. And, you know, it's telling that they're only getting here now.
Yeah, it's definitely not reasonable to expect any sort of, you know, 360 type, you know, thing to average to continue for Whit Merrifield for the rest of his career. But as you said, you know, that he's proven that he can hang to a certain extent at the major league level. And if that's what he can do and give you value, I mean, because the biggest thing about Whit Merrifield that I think why the Royals really like him and why they've given him this chance now and he's taken advantage of it is he does all those little Royal things really well. So he will push a long single into a double. Yeah. He might push a double into a triple. He, you know, he dives after ground balls. He plays a pretty solid second base. He'll steal a base or two. All those little things, he can throw down a bunt when he needs to, regardless of my distaste for the act. He can do it and do it pretty well. So all those things that the Royals really treasure in players, he can do. And he's got that versatility, you know, where I think second base is probably his chosen position if he was given the choice and the place that he's probably the most effective at. But, you know, similar to Ben Zobrist, but I think he can play pretty much anywhere. And I mean, that's really valuable because if you get, especially if,
well,
you know,
they gave them the opportunity yesterday, they gave Chester Cuthbert a day off. Cause I don't think he's completely full speed after colliding with Sal the other, you know, over the weekend, but you give him a chance to have a day off so he can be in the lineup today. And, you know, you can put Witt in left field at any time, you know, I mean, he can play all over and he can play them capably. And you know, just having that availability makes it so that you can mess with the lineup, you can give guys days off, and if nothing else, you know you can always put them back in that anchor position and should be good to go.
Yeah, and it's really that's a really valuable thing to have. So the Royals may have kind of discovered something, and that's great if they do, but to think that it could lead to, you know, being this and, you know, this all this, oh my God, how did everyone miss out on that? You know, pump the brakes on that a little bit.
Yeah.
But that's,
it's happened before, so it's not like it can't happen. And he might be hitting 300 in September and look like a guy going into next year where they don't have to worry about second base anymore. And that would be a pretty nice thing, in my opinion, because then you can maybe look at not having Omar Infante around.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is a good thing to me.
Oh, yes. Definitely a good thing. And, you know, then also kind of a incidental benefit of that as well is if he's a guy that you're comfortable with starting 2017 as your second baseman, then that gives Raul Mondesi some additional time in the minor leagues to season just a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because I think from the discussions we've had with Clint Scholes, who's kind of the big minor league guy for Baseball Prospectus Kansas City, his impression was that there was a really good chance Raul Mondesi would have been up this year if not for the suspension, and still possibly a chance once he comes back from the suspension sometime in late July, I think.
He'll be back from the suspension in early July, I would think at that stage that they would still want to give him some time in Omaha before they jump him up. So I think this year, if you see him in Kansas City, it's going to be September. And that's about it. But I mean, it did seem like they were ready to bring him up. You know, if they needed him in late July or in August, I don't think they would have hesitated. I think they would have just went with it and been like, look, Omar's, you know, the Royals know that Omar's not good, but they owe him like $15 million if they cut him. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, you got to kind of make the business decision and be like, well, you know, maybe he can do something. Maybe if we rest him, he'll be fine and maybe a little bit productive. If nothing else, he's a veteran there who can have, I guess, some value. But, you know, it's tough to cut a guy with that much money left on his deal, especially when you don't have a slam dunk guy to take over. But I do think that they might have had a pretty good, pretty good thought to put Mondesi in that spot and just, you know, throw him in the deep end, see if he can swim away and make it work that way. And, you know, now I think that is delayed by this suspension, but, you know, it's still not. I mean, if Merrifield doesn't adjust and he struggles in the next month or two and they try Christian Colon again at second and he's, you know, still doing his normal thing of, you know, basically hitting 270 with no walks or power, well, I mean, maybe they do. Maybe they do try to go with the guy with tools and upside and see if something develops out of it when he's pushed into a challenging situation, which maybe that's something he'll respond to, or maybe that's a really bad development move. We, I guess, would see in that hypothetical. But, yeah, you're right. And Merrifield playing well allows them the option of seeing more of Mondesi in the minors when he's able to come back. It doesn't push them into a position where they have to, okay, well, we got to have somebody, let's just bring him up. That's an Allard Baird kind of move.
Yeah.
Don't need to be doing
bad
that.
Royals move. And it's something where he's in the position that Salvador Perez in that 2010, 2011 range, time frame was in, where the word on him was always Perez is absolutely ready. Basically, since he was in Double A, they were saying he was ready to, from a defensive standpoint, to be a major league catcher. Mm-hmm. And yet it was the bat that needed more seasoning, needed to develop a little bit. And then injury circumstances happened. And then he came up and just kind of took off from there and never looked back. So I think Mondesi is kind of in that same boat, or at least he was going into the beginning of the season, where defensively he's ready and the bat was picking up, but still needed a little bit more season to prove he could kind of hang from a major league perspective. And so now, you know, with that, with the suspension, maybe it'll give him time to, you know, kind of – because we were Jim Callis we had on, and he was – that was – remember, he was saying he – if it was his decision, he would kind of slow down Mondesi a little bit because he's been moving pretty quick the last couple of years, and he would probably slow him down a little bit and give – and he was hoping that he had more time to season in the minors, that it would help him eventually when he got to the majors. So, you know, one of those kind of – blessings in disguise, if you will. I don't think missing time is ever a good thing, but
right,
you know, if there can be a good thing, discovering Whit Merrifield and or giving him more time to develop, you know, might not be the worst thing in the world.
Yeah, I mean, if you find yourself a new everyday second baseman who can play other spots, that's excellent, especially when he's making the league minimum. You know, that's money you don't have to invest in another spot. So and if it does give you that extra benefit of, hey, our top prospect can actually develop at a normal timeline, that's even better. So I,
because then for your theoretical 2018 season, you know, if Escobar leaves and the Royals don't re-sign him, then, you know, you could plug Merrifield back in at second and just move Mondesi over to short. And then you've got those two positions taken care of. So, you know, again, theoretical, and that's far down the line. Don't need to worry about that yet, but you know, as a if you're dating more, you do have to kind of be looking, having, you always have to be worrying about the team at hand, but you also kind of have to have that eye towards the future and thinking about these things and how are the pieces all going to fit next year, 2 years, 3 years from now.
Yep. It's what can we expect from this guy or that guy, and you know, what contingency do we have here and there and everywhere else? I mean, it's, you have to have those guys ready, because you know, it's, that's why you always hear in spring training, you hear so much about depth and inventory and things like that, because they want to have these guys available. I mean, you could probably go through and just, oh, I want this guy, I want this guy, I want this guy, sign him, move him around, whatever. But then you get into that spot where, hey, maybe you've dropped a guy like Merrifield, or maybe you've left Eibner unprotected and someone takes him as a Rule 5 guy. And now you don't have those guys available. You don't have them, you know, where they're, you know, you probably have an idea of what they can do at this stage. You know, they're not probably going to develop into superstars, like we said, but they, you know, Eibner can still be a good fourth outfielder, or possibly, if pressed, an occasional starter. And Merrifield, he could be an everyday second baseman possibly, and they're learning that right now. And you know, if you just drop them and say, well, they're not going to make it, you don't get to find that out. Or if you do find it out, it's at your own expense, because it's the team you're facing has your guy for cheap starting against you and playing at least average or reasonably well or above replacement, and that's a loss for an organization. So that's why
I believe they
always agonize over these decisions, and it always seems like, what are they thinking? What are they waiting on? And then you see, and it's like, all right, I guess I see why they kept that guy around, or why they didn't just jump at this move, because this guy was really good for a week in spring training in Arizona. It's like, well, okay, they have to really take a long look at every step down the path and figure out where these guys might fit and which guys they think can contribute. And, you know, Merrifield especially is definitely contributing better than, you know, anybody. It's probably like Mike Aviles is probably the last guy who just came out of nowhere to play well. And in a month, that might change. You know, he might not be hitting this well in a month, but he might still be hitting this well. So we get to kind of find that out, and it's kind of fun to watch that develop as it goes along.
Yeah, and, you know, the Royals, I mean – a guy like Johnny Giovitella was a guy that the Royals just kind of gave up on, more or less. And he hasn't become an all-star. He's not, you know, super great, but, you know, he's given some solid play to the Angels the last couple of years. So, you know, similar, Whit Merrifield is in a similar situation. And thankfully, this is one of those scenarios where kind of an injury might actually be – it's not a good thing. I'll never – you know, I don't want to say that, but it gives them the opportunity to play Whit Merrifield every day and see what he's about. Whereas, you know, Johnny Giovitella, it was never really that type of a scenario. It was always kind of, we're going to give him a shot for a couple weeks, and if he didn't start off super hot, then it was just kind of over. But Whit Merrifield, they don't really have a choice. And, you know, if it, as of today, you're thinking to yourself, well, if the Royals had to field an infield with, you know, Mondesi, Merrifield, and Cuthbert, I don't know what they're, you know, who would play first base, but, you know, you could do worse as of today from what we've seen from those players and what we expect from a player of the caliber of Mondesi.
Yep. And I just looked up Johnny Giovitella is hitting .278 this year for the Angels. He has
power. His power is essentially non-existent. Yeah. But
he has four fewer hits than Albert Pujols. He does have two homers, but you know, it's only two homers.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you know, reasonable. He's doing better than Omar. 677 OPS. I mean, that's, you can live with that.
Yeah.
So
if he's playing solid defense, you know, I mean, it's not
that, I don't know. I don't know how his defense is doing. I haven't watched enough Johnny Giovitella.
Yeah. I pulled up his Fangraphs page. It looks like he's at 0.2 in defensive war. So, I mean, he's just, you know, he's
It's fine. He's, you know, I guess he's not booting it.
Yeah, he's essentially just like a small notch above replacement level, which, again, is better than Omar Infante. But,
yep.
You know, and that's really, I mean, you can live with that. You know, you don't want to have that at every position on the field, but at what, a position or two, you can live with that.
Mm-hmm. So, yep.
And that, I was just going to, I think, you have anything to add to that?
No.
Okay, that's kind of covered.
I'm Giovitella it out.
That's kind of covered the main happenings with the Royals right now. So we'll take a short break here, and then when we come back, it's going to be that time of year again, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Start voting. We have some thoughts. Stick with us.
Mm-hmm.
You'll hear it when we come back on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
The Kansas City Baseball Vault will be right back after these messages.
Brand new Royal Stadium in Kansas City's Harry S. Truman Sports Complex is the attractive setting for this year's game. Hosting this all-star occasion are Mr. and Mrs. Ewing Kaufman. And with a stadium record crowd of almost 41,000 streaming in, everything certainly is up to date in Kansas City.
The Vault.
Hi, this is Ned Baudet for Kelly's Westport Inn. Summertime is here. And that means one thing. Your neighbor's cat sneaks over and craps in your garden. No, of course, I'm just joking. Summer also means my neighbor borrowing your boat trailer and driving it into Smithville Lake, or mosquitoes, or your three-year-old drinking the air conditioner water. Haha, I guess what I'm saying here is that summer means different things to different people. And for 65 years, Kelly's Westport Inn has been a vacation for those summer problems ever since Randall Kelly poured his first frosty draft in 1947. 102 degrees and 99% humidity? Don't worry, Kelly's is air conditioned, and the drinks are as cold as ice. And when the heat breaks, Randall's Rooftop is ready for you to kick back, or you can head downstairs for some of the best live music in town. Summer is different things to different people, but to everyone in Kansas City, Kelly's Westport is your summertime bar. I'm Ned Baudet for Kelly's Westport Inn. We'll leave the taps on for you.
Back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, Baseball Perspectives affiliate. Folks, there's something that we forgot to talk about in the first segment that bears mentioning, so we're going to talk about it before we get into All-Star voting. And that was actually an unintentional pun, but
you should have just owned it.
I should have. Bears mentioning, but it is in fact a bear suit worn by Danny Duffy on occasion. I haven't seen him break it out this year.
I think he only did it in the clinching of the Central. I would have figured he would have done it maybe at the pennant or something else.
Something like that. But yeah.
All right. I'm not going to begin to try to
understand
what his yes. parameters for using the bear suit.
What your typical
are.
Bear suit reasoning is.
Right. I know what mine would be. Mine would probably be, you know, every serious win that you get, but that's me.
You know, yeah. What are you going to do?
I don't know. Grin and bear it, I guess.
We're on fire. But anyway, Danny Duffy. So he has obviously started the season in the bullpen, spent some time there because of injuries, thrust back into the rotation. And, I mean, he has really been looking sharp. And he has really kind of looks like so far that he's kind of put things I don't want to say put things together necessarily, but he has, he's done, looked really sharp. I'm pulling up everything so I can get his exact stats here. He had, so since he's been in the starting rotation, the last three games, he pitched three innings in his first game in the rotation, gave up one hit.
Like a 40 or 50 pitch count.
Really short
like
pitch
that.
Limit. Threw 48 pitches, one hit. No runs, no earned runs, two walks, five strikeouts. Solid three innings right there, 48 pitches. And 48 pitches and three innings for Danny Duffy, that's 16 pitches an inning. But for his – based on his history, that's pretty solid.
Yeah, he's usually been like 18 as a starter, which doesn't sound like much. But when you take two extra pitches and you're five innings in, that's 10 extra pitches or six. That's 12. Yeah. You know, so it's basically –
You're pretty much
an inning short of where you could be if you were more efficient.
Because when it stacks up like that, you start to put the manager, you know, you put Ned Yost in a sticky situation because, you know, that 100 pitch count is kind of the mile marker, if you will, for most pitchers. So if you're averaging 18 an inning and you're after five innings, you've got 90 pitches, do you risk bringing Danny Duffy out for the next inning, knowing he might be getting close to tired, knowing that it could be one of those bad 20 plus pitch innings, and then his pitch count rockets over 110 or whatever, you know? Whereas if he's at 80 pitches through five innings, then you can comfortably say, okay, there's a good chance he's going to get out of this inning with less than 100 pitches. And then he's gotten through six innings, he's had 100 pitches or less, pretty solid. You know, if he gets a five pitch inning and he's only at 85 pitches, maybe you can squeeze another inning out of him. Who knows? You know, but you give a little bit more options there. But if you're sitting at 90, you extremely limit those options. Now, his second outing, 4.1 innings pitched, four hits, again, zero runs, zero earned runs, no walks, and three strikeouts. Another, again, his pitch count was extended a little bit into the 60-65 range. He had 63 pitches and 4.1 innings, which is pretty good. That is
15.
Yeah, ish.
Less than 15 if he got that extra out in the
exactly.
In
so
the
decreasing that pitch count, the per inning pitch count a little bit, and then his next outing against the White Sox, he had 5.1 innings pitched. This is a little bit misleading because he had literally five perfect innings.
Right.
And then the point one.
He got the first 16 guys out.
First 16 guys out. And then some kind of semi-fluky hits. Some things didn't go his way.
Two really bad pitches. Gives up a
home run.
Yeah.
Gives up a home run right after it. Next thing you know, he gave up five runs, five hits, five earned runs. But again, no walks and five strikeouts and 5.1 innings pitched. So, you know, all told, he had those three games. He had 12.2 innings pitched, only gave up those five earned runs, 13 strikeouts, and look at it, they don't have his outing last night. They don't have it up yet in the game logs. So, but he pitched really well, and kept
also really efficient. I think he threw like 78 pitches through six innings.
Oh, wait. Yeah, I'm an idiot. There it is right there. My bad. Six innings pitched, seven hits, three runs, three earned runs. And again, none of those balls, the most of those seven hits, and especially the ones that ended up being those runs, were not sharply hit balls. And again, no walks, 6 strikeouts in 6 innings pitched and 75 pitches. I mean, 75 pitches on for Danny Duffy for 6 innings.
That could be 3 a lot of times a couple years ago.
Yeah.
You know, last year, that would be pretty easy to see him go with 25 pitches in an inning.
So, I mean, all these signs, I'm gonna add this in here. So in those four, since he's been back in the starting rotation, those 4 games, 18.2 innings pitched, yep. 8 earned runs, only 2 walks in 18.2 innings pitched and 19 strikeouts.
Yeah.
For a 3.86 ERA. And that's inflated by one bad third of an inning, essentially. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you, again, you can't throw it out,
but at the same time, it doesn't illustrate how well he was pitching that day.
Exactly.
Because he looked as good in those first five innings as I've seen a Royals pitcher throw in a long time. Like, he had everything working. Changeup was nasty. Fastball was 96 to 98. He had his breaking ball was working for him too. I mean, he was good. Yeah. And then, you know, a couple balls fall in and he hangs a slider and he gives up a grand slam and then throws a meatball and, you know, it looks really bad. But,
and some of that could have been, you know, fatigue starting to set in. They're still trying to stretch him out, and he was coming up on the end of his pitch limit, but he had a perfect game going through 5 innings, and Ned Yost is not the guy who is, you know, beholden to the pitch count in those situations. So had Danny Duffy given up maybe 1 run and a couple hits, he probably would have taken him out. But if you have a perfect game going through 5 innings, manager's not going to take you out. I don't care what your pitch count is. You know, maybe –
if he got maybe into like the 90s, he might. And, you know, when you've got Herrera and Davis behind you,
yeah,
you can maybe be a little more.
But after 5 innings, definitely would have given him this. Just that.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't fault Ned for that necessarily. But, you know, that could have been part of what was leading into him giving up some of those runs. But, I mean, you're right. He's looked about as good as I've seen a Royals pitcher look in a long time. So that's very encouraging.
Yep. And overall, I mean, he just has a 40-7 strikeout to ball ratio or strikeout to walk ratio, which is for Danny Duffy, that's crazy. That just doesn't even seem right. You know, his last, that start before against the White Sox was the second highest strike percentage by a starter this year behind Max Scherzer in that game where he struck out 20 guys. So that's kind of the level that he was at. He was just throwing really well. He had that really poor inning. As a starter, he's giving up 3.5 pitches per batter, which is really good, especially for Danny Duffy. And he's still getting strikeouts. You know, he's got 19 strikeouts in 18.2 innings as a starter. So it's not like he's just getting a bunch of one pitch outs and they're bringing those down. He's still getting strikeouts. Like last night, he had in that 4th inning, he struck out the side on 10 pitches. I mean, that's as close to that immaculate inning as you can get.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he's throwing really well. And I want to see as he goes through, as he maybe faces teams a second time or as his pitch count increases, you know, how he continues as a starter. But when you've got some weirdness with that 5th spot between Dillon Gee and Chris Medlin and Chris Young, who's going to start this weekend against the Indians in place of Dillon Gee, you know, to have Duffy step up and really not just fill that role, but be really effective in that role as a starter is really, really key. And, you know, if he continues that way and Volquez and Kennedy are pretty good, then you can kind of see what you get from Ventura and feel pretty good about the rotation for the rest of the year.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, pretty much all you can ask from Duffy at this point. And sometimes some pitchers, you know, depending on who they are and for whatever reason, just being able to come back to the bullpen or go to the bullpen and then come back to starting from there, just having to switch up your mindset going from a starter to the bullpen and then going back to a starter, you know, sometimes just in anything in life, when you do something one way and then you do it another way and then you come back to doing it the original way, you realize, okay, I can still do this, but I can tweak it a little bit based on the information I gleaned from doing it this other way, you know. So there, you know, that's, I mean, there, it used to be back in the day that pretty much all pitchers started out coming up and being in the bullpen for a little while before they assumed a perceived role as a starter. But there's no, you know, there's no patience for that anymore necessarily. So some pitchers still need that. And that could be what Danny Duffy needed. You know, hopefully, I'm hoping it is. I hope this is real and he's turned that corner and he's realizing that potential that we've all seen for years. Moving on from Danny Duffy, the final topic that we'll leave you with as you're listening here is it's that time of year again. And it is All-Star Game voting season. And the Royals, again, are representing. It's not quite to the fever pitch that it was last year, but we've got Eric Hosmer leading all first basemen. And this year, it's legitimate. That is not something that is, you know, just, oh, we're just voting in Hosmer because he's Hosmer. I mean, this year, he should be the All-Star game, just based on how he's doing relative to the other first basemen in the American League and basically in Major League Baseball in general. He should be starting. So that's legit. And then the real anarchy for all this is Omar Infante is
as
second.
Always, which was the rallying cry last year too.
Yes,
so
it's to make a mockery of the situation. But what's absolutely really interesting is if you look at the other side, the National League, they have what the Royals had last year. Cubs fans, the Cubs are doing fantastic this year. Cubs fans have gone off the wall crazy, and they're literally the entire infield right now for the National League are Cubs starters.
Which, I mean, Rizzo's good. Zobrist is incredible right now. Chris Bryant's really good. But Addison Russell is not the best shortstop in the NL. And really, Chris Bryant, as good as he is, Nolan Arenado is playing better. So, I mean, I get if there's any hand-wringing, yes, you can easily recognize that maybe those aren't the best guys at that position, but they're good, and it's reasonable to see that the Cubs, who their fan base is probably the most similar to the Royals, if I were to judge them based on Twitter, just because they're just as goofy and they have just as many weird and confusing inside jokes as we do. You know, they're a little bit annoying this year because you see the Cubs game is on and, oh, they scored another 15 runs. And it's like, oh, great, good for you. And none of their pitchers give up runs. And it's just like, well, it's really annoying to watch a team just be that good. But, you know, the Cubs fans are excited, you know, and with good reason.
They should be.
Yeah, they absolutely should be. And this comes down to a voting contest. It's not one ballot, one person. So, you know, if you've got a fan base that's motivated enough to jump up and do it, you're going to see those results. And Cubs fans are excited and one of the most loyal fan bases ever. They'd have to be at this stage. You know, it's been forever since they won a World Series, almost literally. And the Royals, when, you know, you look at them, like you said earlier, the Royals set two new TV ratings records in the last 2 days, you know, and beating records from last year. So, I mean, you're looking at basically more people are watching Royals games in this area than are watching literally the next like two programs combined in Kansas City. This is it's
nuts.
You know, it's crazy. You've got a ton of people invested and fired up about the Royals and they're playing well. And you've got two-time pennant winners, last year's World Series winner, playing well again with really easy-to-like stars. Sal Perez is the top vote-getter in all of baseball with good reason. He's playing well. He's very marketable. He's really charismatic. He's fun. And everybody loves him. Well, for the most part, unless he's chasing that slider outside. So it's reasonable to say that, you know, these are going to be two excited fan bases who are voting up their players, but the media really have to go out of their way. They're not even going out of their way. This is what I call free column week. Because all you have to do is look at it and, oh, look, all the Royals, they're voting all this. Well, they must be either A, they're doing something nefarious, or B, they're disrespecting the game and it's not right. And it's just like, this is the All-Star game. You know, this is a game where 10 years ago, Mark Loretta, who wasn't doing anything, was voted in as an all-star because he happened to play in Boston at a really good time to be playing in Boston. You know, nobody cared. Didn't matter. You know, hey, he's in. Boom, he's in. A couple years ago, Mike Napoli was playing for the Rangers. He was voted into the all-star game. He had like 12 homers and was hitting 240. You know, it's not like he was hitting 20 homers and hitting 300. He wasn't hitting, but he got voted in. I mean, this is what happens. Fans are going to vote. And if you give fans the opportunity to vote more than one time, and if you base it on, you know, an email address, if a fan wants to, they're going to find a way to vote a ton. Because, you know, if you're in a waiting room, if you're just killing time through your lunch break, it's really easy to vote. They make it really easy to vote. And if you've got multiple email addresses, well, they don't really do anything to cancel those out. So, you know, this is just, every fan has access to all of these same procedures and resources. And it irks me when guys are like, well, you're definitely doing something. It's like, no, they have ways to figure out who's gaming the system. They can look at what, you know, they throw votes out every single year based on, you know, trying to use the same email address or whatever, you know, something doesn't look right, something looks like a bot. They can figure those things out. Mm-hmm. MLB has a lot of technology, believe it or not. And even for something as small as an email voting contest, they can figure that stuff out. And so if you're looking at a city where everybody watches the Royals, you're looking at a parade that drew 800,000 reportedly. And what's the size of the metro area? It's not 800,000.
Roughly 2 million.
Well, I mean, in like the proper.
Oh, city proper, it's like 450,000.
Yeah. So you're drawing. I was out there and I saw people from Texas. I saw people from Iowa. People came from Western Kansas. People came from Southwestern Missouri and Arkansas. And people came from all over to see that because Royals fans are all over. And it was a big event. So it stands to reason that if people are that fired up to come through multiple states to come to a parade, which was actually kind of terrible when I was there, it was really frustrating to be there. If they're going to put up with that kind of traffic and congestion and everything, an email contest to vote for your guy five times is nothing. It's nothing. And so when people get all worked up about how, oh, this isn't right for the game, it's like, it's an exhibition. You know, if it didn't determine the home field advantage of the World Series, which it shouldn't, and that's a dumb part of all of this, it's stupid. You know, who cares? You know, it's not like it worked out last year where the Royals had their entire starting nine out there. Josh Donaldson started at third. You know, Omar Infante did not make the All-Star team, and the guys that did end up starting were pretty reasonable. It basically corrected itself as other fans realized that, oh, I can vote more than once. And that's all Royals fans are doing. They're just voting as much as they can because they're fired up to do it. So if you look at a team last year, again, won the World Series, had this huge fan base convene on Kansas City in November, and, you know, they set an attendance record, they set ratings records. This year, they have a good shot to, they're drawing about 32,000 a game, and school just got out. So I would expect that to go up as it goes along. They have a shot to break the attendance record again. So you've got an entire city that is just willing to vote for their guys. And the more people get worked up on saying, well, you're disrespecting the game, deserving players aren't getting in, it just makes people vote more. Because it's chaos, and the more you tell people, especially in like the Midwest, hey, don't do that, we don't care, we're gonna do it, you know. Especially if you're writing it from Boston, like, guy from Boston's gonna tell someone in Missouri what to do, shut up, you know. So that, yeah, it irked me last year, and it irks me again this year, and it's probably me getting way too worked up again this year, but it's really annoying to see it happen. That, just take the simplest route to the conclusion here. You've got a decent sized fan base doing something that's very easy, and other fan bases that aren't doing it. You know,
what really annoys me the most about it is, what annoys me a lot about a lot of things that baseball or The same thing that annoys me about this is the same thing that a lot of baseball writers use and a lot of baseball writing that annoys me is this sort of – this sanctity of the game argument, right, and sanctity of X argument, you know, whether it's all-star game voting or golden glove voting or, you know, whatever the hell it is.
Or
and it's just like
– hats.
This, yeah, like there is no sanctity, okay? This game is entertainment. I want my entertainment value. And if entertainment for me is voting with five separate email addresses 35 times each, that's what I'm going to do. And that's not something that should be kind of, you know, shamed or looked down upon. It should be praised. The fact that people are out, and I'm obviously biased towards this, but I don't care, there's a little bit of bias, but at the same time, I don't care about the Cubs fans. Start the whole damn Cubs team. They probably deserve it this year, but right, you know, start the whole team. I don't care, because anything that in this era of, you know, fracturing fan bases just because of the way media is consumed and things like that, anything that can get people together and voting for teams, just paying more attention to baseball when we all know football is king and all these different things are going on, you know, that's a good thing and should be praised. And it's similar, you know, it kind of goes back to, you know, the DH argument, right? Like whether, you know, people – I've made this argument on Facebook. I have a lot of friends from St. Louis and –
I'm sorry.
I know, because of where I went to college. So I've made a comment on Facebook in the past where I'll say like, man, the DH is so – or the pitcher's hitting is so stupid. The DH needs to be in the NL. And there's people that just come back, you know, come
right,
back. And,
right,
you know, the only argument – when I really pressed, like, what do you honestly feel the pitcher hitting brings to baseball more than anything else? They say, oh, well, I think there's a soul to baseball. And pitcher's hitting is – and, like, we're not going to get too far into this, but – right. My whole point of bringing that up is just this idea that there's this kind of, you know, whatever ultimate thing that baseball that's binding baseball together through the generations. It's like, I mean, baseball wasn't even integrated until the 40s.
Right.
And, you know, Babe Ruth never had to face an African-American pitcher, and Josh Gibson never got to tear up baseball like he would have, you know, when he was in his prime. It's just there's all these things that, you know, Ty Cobb, who was just kind of revered as this great bastion, was an awful, awful person by literally all accounts. You know, so you're talk about the soul of the game.
Yeah,
there's a lot of soul of the game.
It's not a game.
Not very great.
Yeah, exactly.
This is entertainment. It's entertainment value, and if I'm getting more entertainment for my money, my theoretical money, by voting 35 times or voting for whoever, then so be it. So people on the soapbox, grandstanding, on the high horse about all-star game voting, pick a different topic, take a day off, whatever. Yeah, get over yourself.
On that note, two or three smaller points and then I'll be done on my all-star soapbox. One, if you compare the all-star games, baseball's is the most similar to the actual game of all of them. You watch, nobody watches the Pro Bowl because it's awful. Nobody cares to be at the Pro Bowl. Nobody plays in the Pro Bowl.
Players themselves literally make any excuse not to go.
Right. So you get situations where the eighth guy who could make the team makes it. That's how Alex Smith makes a Pro Bowl. You know, so
it's a Pro Bowler forever, though.
Right, right. Well, I think I'm a Pro Bowler in some position. I don't even know. I lost the letter. And then you get to the NBA and there's no defense and no, it's a glorified AAU game. Hockey, they're working on stuff to kind of make it.
Then they try
fun.
A 3-on-3 thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's probably more entertaining than anything because it's such a novelty, but you know, in the regular game, nobody cares, you know, nobody's going to go all out on defense. And that's not to say that guys are playing like crazy in baseball, but the game, you can't just like, well, I'm going to walk to the wall when the ball goes into the gap. You know, you're not going to just take the playoff. You know, guys only have to play two innings at a time. So they just go and they play and they go sit down. And it looks like any other normal game with just more pitching changes and position changes. So that's one thing. It's like you're not, you know, the game is kind of hard to break from that standpoint. Two, the sanctity of the All-Star game kind of lost it when Larry Walker took off his helmet, turned it around, and hit right-handed against Randy Johnson.
Very
funny. I mean, it's hilarious. It's a good moment, but it doesn't...
Was that Larry Walker? Why did I think that was John Kruk?
I think it was Kruk the year before that got thrown behind, or maybe
the bat before.
And so Walker was coming up, and or maybe it was both of them. I don't know. But at any rate, that happened, and it was a funny moment. But, you know, you can't really sit there and tell me that this game is sanctified because it's just because it's baseball. And three, when you look at the full results right now, you look at the Orioles and the Red Sox, they have pretty much the same number of guys starting. They have pretty much the same number of guys in top fives. Nobody's accusing them of stuffing the ballot box. And the Royals won a series against each of them so far to this point. So, you know, that doesn't seem to add up to me either. So that's all I've got on that soapbox. I'd say go vote like crazy. Vote for guys you want. You know, if you think Jose Altuve should be the guy you want to vote for him. If you want to see chaos and vote for Omar Infante, do it. You know, it's your vote. It's your 35 votes or whatever. It's your 10 email addresses. If you want to take the time to do it, go do it and let the columnists find something else to write about.
Yes, and as we near a very important election season for our country, it's very important to remember it is your vote and you can do with it as you choose.
Yes.
So on that very patriotic note, we'll end the show for this evening. Thank you, everyone, so much for listening. Thank you for listening to our All-Star Game rumblings, as well as as well as talking about the Royals. So as we are signing off now, the Royals are currently winning against the Indians. Hopefully they can extend their lead over them for the division and keep this train moving, keep it rolling, and just keep doing good things. And we'll have more positive Royals things to talk about as we move forward. So,
and before we go, a reminder that June 10th at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum will be a Pitch Talks event, which features Jonah Carey, Tim Raines, and Andre Dawson. But there's also another group that will be Jeff Passan, Sam Mellinger. I always forget the third guy in that group. I feel terrible. I'll have it up on the website.
Yes.
And then there's going to be a local / Royals / blogger panel, which includes myself and Darren Watson from Baseball Prospectus Kansas City, and Max Reaper and Minda Haas-Kuhlman from Royals Review, who are probably the two best representatives you could find from there. They both do great work over there. So you go to homestandsports.com, and they're doing an event in Toronto tonight, I think. And so ours on the 10th is next up. So you should be able to just go to, there's a little go to the show link, and it'll give you a list of the cities they'll be in. Kansas City should be right there. If you use the promo code BPRO at checkout, you will save $5 off the $25 ticket price. And the really cool thing is, because it's at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum and Bob Kendrick is the best human in the world almost, he's also including a one-year membership to the museum with that purchase of a ticket, which the basic membership for 1 year is $25 on its own. So for $20 with the B Pro promo code, you can get access to this event and a year membership to the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. I mean, if you're at all interested, absolutely go.
That is one hell of a deal.
Like, even if I wasn't there, I would be telling people to go, because that's just a super cool event. You know, how often are we going to get to see Andre Dawson and Tim Raines in Kansas City to talk about the old Expos team and their Hall of Fame careers? Tim Raines will be a Hall of Famer. And you get to go for $20. I mean, that's not much. It's going to be probably 3 hours of talking about baseball with some really smart people and also me. So,
indeed.
And then you get that year-long membership to the museum, which anytime, if you're a member and you go, that's free admission. So you know, anytime they have any new exhibit, you can just go check it out. And you're right there by Arthur Bryant, too. So,
boom.
So there you
that
go.
That sounds like an entire evening that Michael Engel just planned for everyone right there.
Pretty much. I've done that day. It was awesome. It was great. You go to the museum, and then you go get barbecue. Perfect.
There it is.
So I would urge everybody to go check it out if you're in the Kansas City area. We want to see you out there. You know, help us spread the word if you're really psyched up like I am. Probably not. I'm probably more excited about this than anybody because I think it's...
There's a good chance.
I think it's really cool. And so I'm probably really annoying people on Twitter about it, but they only have to wait another week for it. And if you buy a ticket, then I'll still be tweeting about it, but maybe you'll feel a little more warm inside. I don't know.
Who knows?
Something like that.
So there you go. Be a part of the Pitch Talks event at the Negro League Baseball Museum and support the Negro League Baseball Museum as much as possible for our friend Bob Kendrick. It's a fantastic place, a very important part of baseball history, and one that it's fun to go down there. So with that, we will leave you on this evening, morning, afternoon, wherever you're listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you so much for listening. Hopefully the Royals can keep this thing moving. We can keep the positivity ladder going up, 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 more and more towards that, the promised land that they've reached last year. You know, it's just, we won't go that far yet, but that's, you know, hopefully that can be, you know, in the sights. So thank you so much for listening. Tune in next week for more Royals talk, and we will see you then. And as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to kansascitybaseballvault@gmail.com.